from HanselMinutes.com. It's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 361, recorded live Thursday, March 7th, 2013. Support for Hansel Minutes is provided by Telerik, offering the best in developer tools and support. Online at telerik.com. And by franklins.net, training developers to work smarter, and now offering GesturePack, a powerful gesture recording and recognition system for Microsoft Kinect for Windows developers. Details at gesturepak.com. In this episode, Scott talks with Willem Larson from Language Hunters.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman. This is another episode of Hansel Minutes, and I'm here at Agile Open Northwest, and I'm sitting down with Willem Larson from languagehunters.org. How are you, sir?
Good, Scott.
Thank you so much for talking to me today. This is really fascinating because I have a passion for languages. I know that the people who follow me online know that I'm always thinking about languages, particularly smaller, more obscure languages, not Spanish and French and German, but, you know, Ethiopian and Zulu and things like that. So what is Language Hunters, and why would a person with passion in language care about Language Hunters?
Language Hunters is a 501c3 nonprofit that whose purpose is to revitalize endangered languages, and actually specifically to teach communities to do that work themselves, which is a big issue because oftentimes these small languages are cultural property, especially in North America. You have Native American languages that belong to the people, you know, maybe one of the most valuable things they hold. And so we teach them to do all that work themselves, and for all members, from kids to elders, to participate in that revival of their language.
When I think of learning a language, though, I think of, you know, the ubiquitous, like Rosetta Stone, I'll buy a bunch of CDs, I'll get the Lonely Planet sheet. It sounds like hassle and hard work. And for a small language, there isn't a Lonely Planet for those.
Right. Yeah. We like to think of language hunting as like the rugged all-weather version of language acquisition. You don't need CDs. You don't need any kind of computers. You don't need any extraneous expensive tools. Now, it's wonderful to have them. Don't get me wrong. I've recorded a lot of language hunts, is what we call it when we learn languages live from a live speaker in the moment. And I do record them on occasion for mnemonic purposes and for documentation, but it's not required. Language hunting has to work at the end of a dirt road with no electricity, with people who may have really difficult, you know, social issues going on, poverty, lack of access to all kinds of resources. And so it's optimized for the most challenging of situations, which is funny because then it makes learning French pretty much a snap.
When I try to teach, when I try to get my wife to help me with my Zulu and Ndebele language, it's a Bantu language that she speaks. Unfortunately, I think I'm coming at it from an engineering perspective, which is like, all right, well, what's the past participle for to be? You know, like, and she doesn't think it that way. She understands what that means, but as a native speaker, she's like, I don't know. You just say it this way. And we always come at this, we always have this impasse where she's not telling it in the way that I want. And I'm not receiving it in the way that she has to give. How can a language hunt change that?
You know, we like to think of language, I think culturally, we've inherited this view of language as information. It's data, and you can put it on a page and it can live there. And that's just simply not the way language works. Now, the study of language, linguistics, is really fascinating. And I'm an amateur linguist myself. And I love talking about language, but language is really an activity. It's something that a human body does. It requires musculature. It requires breath. It requires your brain. Absolutely. It requires your ears, but it's a whole person activity, and you can do it gracefully, fluently, or not so fluently. And there's levels of proficiency. There's levels of complexity of information that you can transmit in this language activity, but it is it's all, you know, it's as physical as any sport. You know, it's not our brains just making beeps and squawks, right? It's far more subtle and intricate than that. And so, what we do with language hunting is we take that as our assumption. And we learn language in context, in situ, from a speaker who has no, ideally has no teaching ability, no linguistic understanding of their language. That actually gets in the way. In fact, if they know English, that can get in the way. Because how they learned English, if it's a second language, will influence how they try and pass on their own language. You know, they'll want to help us by teaching. And then that ends up being teaching about the language, teaching the linguistic knowledge we have of the language, rather than learning the skill of speaking and writing, if that's part of it. So in language hunting, we set up situations, problems that we need to solve. For example, I'm thirsty and I want a glass of water, and we dive into it without a bridge language. We dive right into it, and I learn how to get myself a glass of water using the language. And there can be immense amounts of complicated verb use or idiom, and it doesn't matter because I don't know what's happening. In context, in the hunt, all I know is if I say this thing, the speaker reacts this way. And if I say it a little off, the speaker's brow crinkles, so I don't say it like that. And if I say it spot on, there's a big smile that spreads across their face. And then, all right, I'll keep doing that. And what happens, just like children, I mean, this is how children learn their mother tongue, mm-hmm. the most complex, ornate languages without any even orthography, any written element. There's no books, no literacy possibly. And yet still, young children, toddlers grow up and master this language with no problem, right? And so that's what language hunters are able to do. That same pathway that the natural learning natural language acquisition that children have, and yet we like turn it up to 11, as mm-hmm. Nigel might say. So we apply all kinds of learning accelerators, what we call rules. We gamify it, so they are game rules, and we find ways of one shortcut after another, finding, you know, every way to cheat the system and learn faster.
Mm-hmm. And does that cause it to be, is it easier to hold? Because that's the thing that I'm struggling with, is it makes sense for an hour or two, and then the next day I've lost half of it, and the next day I've lost even more.
That's, well, you know, there's, retention is another issue. You're describing a phenomenon which is probably what we call hysteresis. Neuroscientists say that forgetting is the friend of learning. Which is, yeah, something that'll probably blow your mind, but it's quite true that the human mind, as it builds new structure, it goes back and forth across this boundary line of fluently expressing this new ability or information, and then, whoa, lost it. What was even I talking about? Suddenly I don't understand it, and then I'm back to understanding it. If you stay on it, you're back to understanding it, and then you're back to forgetting it. And what that happens, and within that, that boundary line, though, is moving forward. The structures are gaining in complexity, right? So it's not just one location. If you stop your learning, there's some degradation over time, but even then, if you interact, if you revisit that same material, that same skill, you'll find it comes back much more quickly than a person who's never touched it before. Mm-hmm. And that's how you know that that you really did have that experience. That was hysteresis, and it's a good thing and part of the learning journey.
Mm. Does this work on adults? Because you know how they say a 5-year-old can learn a language, but by the time they're 12, it's too late. And I'm thinking, like, if I go back and study Spanish books, which I learned in, you know, my teens, in my early teens, I'm like, wow, I really know Spanish. Like, it's baked in because it's what I spent 4 years in high school doing.
Yeah.
But if I try to learn French, it just doesn't happen because I'm an old man.
Yeah. That's funny because I took 4 years of Spanish in high school and I can't speak it for anything. this is a problem. I was a language nut in high school. I took like 4 or 5 languages and, French, German, Spanish, a semester of Japanese, a little bit of Russian, a semester of Arabic, right? And I really can't speak any of them.
It's funny. I did the Spanish, like the whole AP Spanish, because you need that to get out of high school.
Yeah.
I did the exact same thing. I did a semester of Arabic.
Yeah.
And I was like totally into Arabic for like, you know, half a year because I had a reason to. I don't know why.
Yeah.
Maybe I wanted to eat at Lebanese restaurants or something. Fun. I don't know. Yeah. And then it's gone.
Yeah.
and there's like six alphabet letters and seven phrases left, and that's all I got.
Yeah, and it's not necessarily a positive sign, like a hysteresis might point us to, because during those years, I was drilling knowledge about the language, but I wasn't drilling the ability to fluently speak the language. So languages that, and of course, this is all before language hunting, languages after the development of language hunting, which has really been a community project. I certainly don't take all credit for the existence of language hunting. We think of it as an open source approach that is, we're constantly iterating on and ever improving, that has these five core elements. But so in any case, how did we get there?
See, hysteresis just
hysteresis.
Happened. Let me ask you this. If I want to go home and try this with my wife, do I need a training course? Do I need to buy something? Or can you give me the basics of what I would do so then I could go and sell my wife on language hunting? Because I want her to teach me Indibeli better.
Well, so what you are going to do, what a language hunter does is teach themselves a language.
Okay.
You don't want her to teach
I don't want her to teach
me. That could trigger all kinds of terrible behaviors.
Well, and already divorce and...
Well, there's that, right? And teach me to drive, please, honey. No, what you want is you don't want to trigger any classroom habits or anything that has to do with the culture of that kind of learning. What you want is to have, what is a traditional food activity that from?
They make this thing called sadza out of cornmeal. They cook it.
Mm-hmm. Is there any kind of drink that's traditional?
No, they're mostly tea. The tea time would be very traditional. Nice. Like simply the creation of like tea time. They're very English over there. Mm-hmm. Afternoon tea, super.
It's funny. Common. And it's funny you say that because that is our default hunt around the world and village societies too. There is a traditional drink, usually tea, which is what? Plants and hot water. So it's not hard to invent this on your own.
Okay.
And so what we do is our default hunt is an empty cup and a full cup of tea. And maybe there's a teapot, maybe not. And what we do is we get really good at that as our backup. But okay. Ideally, you find something that is even more tuned to that culture. Mm-hmm. So the cornmeal might be an even better option. But what you do is you do what we call the tiny hunt.
Okay.
You put a couple of cups down, and we do the tea. You have a cup of tea in an empty cup, and you do what we call killing a fairy. Whenever you translate from one language to another, on a sentence by sentence basis, you're basically, or word for word, even worse, you're killing fairies. You're claiming that this sentence in this nuanced, rich cultural idiom on the left side equals this sentence and this other nuanced, rich cultural idiom that is probably your cultural idiom, so that you think it makes an especially rational, logical sense. And I guarantee you, English is totally crazy.
You're killing me because you're making me feel like that's exactly what I do.
Well, and that's our instinct. That's conventional teaching. And all it is, you know, it's what we call a decelerator. It just slows learning down. It doesn't mean that learning won't happen. It's just the long way around the mountain. Mm-hmm. So we want shortcuts. So what we do is we want to develop the brain. So the target language is Zulu?
The Indibeli is the language, but Zulu is easier to say.
Indibeli. Let's do Indibeli. Now, the reason why I take Indibeli, not Zulu, is because the first thing you want to develop is a sense of the hyper-specificity of what you're hunting. Mm,
that's interesting, because an Indibeli speaker can go to South Africa and speak, and they're mostly understood, but it's almost like Spanish and Italian, or Spanish and Spain versus Spanish and Mexico. There are differences.
There's huge. And not only that, but then if you say, I speak Indibeli, someone won't go, you're speaking Zulu wrong, which happens.
Yeah.
I mean, it happens with Spanish. You're speaking Spanish wrong. There's also status issues, lower class Spanish or high. You want to learn the higher class. No. We want to learn live language. It's always better than the common usage language, what they call standard language. A standardized language is just, as linguists say, is a language with an army, and dialects don't have the army, right? Mm. So what we're doing is always going for what is most alive and vivid right in front of us. And that's where the fastest learning will happen.
See, I like the way that you're phrasing that. It's live because it's in my house
every
day,
all
day for the last 13 years.
Yeah, right. And so Andabeli, let's go back to that hunt.
Okay.
Empty cup, full cup. You're going to kill that first fairy. We do this because it's the hardest thing to hunt in the beginning. It can be done. It might take you an hour, and you might wonder why you spent all that effort. I think it's worth it, but let's make it easy. So you just say, how do you say what is that in Andabeli, right?
Yeah.
So you notice there's not really any teaching going on. Someone's just going to tell you how to say what is that. And then you'll get the information, and then you'll just parrot what they say. This is what we call copycatting. As best as you can, as closely as you can, but mumbling, we have a rule called mumble. Close enough is good enough. Just parrot it right back at them, just like a little kid, and point at one of the cups, the empty cup. So what is that? Now, what'll happen is the speaker usually go, you said it right, or something, but you just don't, that's it. That was that one fairy was the last English you're going to say, and you stay in Andabeli, and you go, what is that?
Okay.
What is that, right? In Andabeli. And sooner or later, the speaker will go, oh, right, and you're pointing at the cup, and the speaker will tell you, da-da-da-da-da. And so then you parrot that back. And then you get a questioning. If once you feel you've got a hold of that, you get a questioning look on your face. And you know, you really summon it, right? And you point at the other cup and really like look like you have a question. Some languages don't have rising intonations like English, so you can't cheat that way. So you've really got to get good at looking confused.
See, that makes me think of American Sign Language, because that's what we taught the kids when we did baby sign language. Mm-hmm. And the man was so expressive with his body. And because we learned sign language from a man who was mute.
Oh, wow. Right.
He was at Portland Community College and he could not speak.
That's amazing.
So he just would, he would slap the table.
Yeah.
And he'd put his finger up and he'd just point and he would use his, it was so, like charades.
Well, absolutely. I'm actually, a lot of deaf speakers, are my heroes and mentors. I mean, they're some of the most eloquent and expressive people I've ever met. I have a mentor, Raven Sequoia, she can tell stories in sign language that just make hair stand up on your neck, and I may not even know half the signs, you know, but you know exactly what's happening. They're so evocative. Mm-hmm. So, and it's funny, of course, you mentioned that because that's what we do is we teach sign language, in coordination with, the language hunting. The sign is not necessary. You can language hunt without arms, right?
Okay.
But it is a helper. It is what we call an accelerator. And so it's one of our game rules is if you can at all, use gesture to boost the vividness of what you're doing. Especially pointing at the cup with your finger. Now you could point with your lips or, you know, with your chin. And in a lot of cultures, that's actually what they do. In traditional cultures, it's rude to point, in some of them. So this is always tuned for the culture that you're working with. Even better, learn Andabeli sign and do this. But so point at the full cup. What is that? You'll get an answer. Go back to the empty cup. You know, and parrot it back.
But as the analytic person in my mind is thinking, well, I haven't spoken English anymore. So I don't we learned what is that. She said cup, presumably.
Mm-hmm.
You know, hopefully she didn't say white or pattern or China. Mm-hmm. We don't know.
Mm-hmm.
She said something.
Mm-hmm.
And then she might say, itie.
Yeah, itie.
Or she might say, full cup, or, you know, who knows what she's, I don't know. I just have to parrot it back. How do I know I'm learning the right thing?
Oh, you'll find out. This is where it gets intriguing. Not only have you already found out as you're using signs, because you're trying to pair signs up, if you're choosing to use that as a booster, which I recommend, in Andabeli, it may be like that is what, it might be that what that is that what, you know, who knows, right?
Yeah, I don't know.
So, but when you get your answers, when you find out. Because what disappears and is filled in with the word that is either cup, empty cup, or whatever, right? The noun adjective segment appears, and what disappears, and bam. Now you at the very least know which sign to pair with that sound, right?
Mm-hmm.
Use your what sign in ASL. So this is what happens. It's like what happens is rather than analyzing over and over and over, you have this sort of shooting from the hip sense of what's going on. Mm-hmm. And everything is like an educated guess. It's like solving a mystery. And you can make things clearer by having better props. The best possible setup is the same colored cup, the exact same shape. Now, if you have an empty white cup and a full black cup, you've set yourself up a headache, right? So empty white cup, empty full cup, exact same designed cup, right? And, you know, the table, maybe you've got a very clean tablecloth with nothing else there, right? Maybe there's a fork next to your cup. Well, does she know what you're pointing at, right? Mm, yeah. So you ask, you know, you point at the empty cup and you say, well, what is that? And she tells you again, and you get your affirmation. And 90% of language hunting is verifying that you know what you know, right? Mm-hmm, okay. So lots of repetition. And then you ask, you with your questioning look, you make the statement that is an empty cup, but with a questioning look.
Ah, okay.
Now, hopefully, you'll get a yes.
Oh, and then you learned yes.
And then you've learned yes.
Okay.
Now, if you don't get the right reaction, what you can do is go to the full cup, and then you say, that is an empty cup, with your questioning look, and then she'll get it. She'll be like, oh, no, that is not an empty cup. That is a full cup. So you get no. You get a negated full sentence, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. and then you get an affirmative sentence. So this is how piece by piece we build up our fluent conversation right from the get-go. I'm a big fan of learning hello, goodbye, niceties, like please, thank you, excuse me, which not all languages have in the same way English has, so keep that in mind. Mm-hmm. But those are easy. Just look in a phrase book and test them out, and you can, you know, you don't have to hunt those per se. But this structure part is what you're hunting. So you've got negation, you've gotten full sentence. Next, you know, you look down the road towards mastering this language. And as you look down that, your next job, this is the what conversation. You now want to master all the rest of the questions of journalism. Who, what, when, where, why, how. We include how many in there. Mm-hmm. And what happened is the capper to this hunt. And once you can answer all those questions, you can pretty much get all your survival needs met really well in the language. And your next task is going to be to stack sentences together and tell stories in the past, present, and future. And it continues, right? So you can hunt your way towards, just like a child does, mm-hmm. towards complete, deep, eloquent fluency in a language at the highest levels of proficiency without ever going into English. Mm-hmm. And learning all the cultural elements that belong to all those conversations, right? So you'll learn how to fill, like in Irish, I've learned how to fill a cup of tea, right? There's a right way to fill a cup of tea, and you may or may not know that you need to actually put in the hot water in the tea cup to warm it up, and then you throw that away, and then you fill it up with your tea water, and now that's a well-filled cup of tea, right? So you learn, in hunting the language, you start to learn all these social niceties and courtships and setups and agreements that are critical towards good relationships with other people who are native speakers of that language.
See, that's interesting. When we have tea at home, we just have tea. But when other Indibele people come over,
yeah.
Suddenly my wife, who I realize that she's African, but she's also American,
right?
When the elders come over, suddenly she's got a towel over her arm and a big bowl, yeah. and she's pouring hot water onto their hands, and she'll take the bowl to them and wash their hands. Wow. And that happens all before the tea.
Wow.
And then when she serves the tea, there's an invisible pecking order.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, elder male, elder female, the little kids come last, you know, the host versus the hostess, all those kinds of things. If I was applying language hunting to those things, it would take longer, but certainly I would be able to pick up all those different things about the pecking order.
And really what you've just described is an immaculate design of a relationship. What's funny about language hunting is it ends up being a relationship hunting. And every culture has these setups, what we call them, these designs where easy, effective, genuine, impactful, positive interactions can happen. between elders and those who are younger, to build communities, build families. And you'll notice, when I talk about how you want those cups the same and there's this simple difference and then, and how gradated the progression is, and that in that same hand washing and the pecking order, it's also present there. As you get deeper in the culture, you realize a lot of these designs have been done for you, right? Mm. That you can, by through observing, you can see how these rituals work and then piggyback on them. It's very cool.
So do I, as the person who wants to learn, drive the discussion in, because the, presumably the person who I want to learn the language from, given that we're pretending that they don't speak English,
yeah,
they're who I pull the information from. I mean, mm-hmm. they're not driving it. So I've done the MDT. Now what? Like, how do I drive the conversation forward?
Oh, well, you just keep asking those questions. If it's already been laid out in obvious fashion that one of those cups is yours and one of those cups is hers, you can move to mine yours through pantomime. Mm. And, you know, just use your imagination or watch kids arguing over this is mine and that is yours. And you'll get how to make those signs, right? These are all very human behaviors. We haven't reinvented the wheel. Then, you know, once you've done that, the next thing is to ask the where question, which can be as easy as, and this is one usually people either invent themselves or guess, or we show them and then they go, why didn't I think of that? You just put the cup under the table, right? And then you act like you can't find your cup, right?
I was trying to figure out, like, how am I going to hide the cup?
It's very easy. And then you start, you know, mumbling, da-da-da-da-da, mm-hmm. empty cup, da-da-da-da-da. You know, like you don't have words, empty cup and on the belly, empty cup and on the belly. And then what happens, just like we do with children, the your wife will say, oh, you want to know where the cup is, mm-hmm. right? Oh, or, oh, where is the cup? It's under the table. And so you manage through trial and error to fish out the part that where is the cup. And you all do also get freebies, right? So if you're a quick enough language hunter, you actually will be able to catch that. You want to know where the cup is. And then it gets compressed when she sees you're confused where the cup is. But now you know, do you want to know? Right? You make a guess. I mean, what did she say? Yeah, yeah. You know, what else could she have said? This is basically Sherlock Holmes. When you've eliminated the impossible, what is left, no matter how improbable, must be the answer, right? And that's language hunting. It's language acquisition through inference and play and speaking, right? So it's supercharged. It really is mystery solving.
But it has a directedness. You're basically describing how I taught my kids English in the last 5 years, uh-huh. except I do this in a directed hour a day.
Aha. Uh-huh. And this brings us back to why adults are far better language learners than children, because children are wonderful. I would say children are not amazing language learners. Children are inevitable language learners. Adults are amazing language learners, but they are not inevitable language learners. So it takes a child from the day they're born about 20 years to reach a college level ability in their language. And I'm not talking a college level language class, but I can go to an English speaking university and hold my own, right? Right? It takes 20 years to get there. Maybe not, maybe 18 if they're precocious. Super precocious, maybe 11. You know, some geniuses, right? But really, it takes about 20 years. You or I go to France, study at a university for 4 years. I think we're going to be pretty far along. We'll be there.
Yeah.
4 years. We know, we've met these people.
Yeah, yeah.
They're everywhere.
I was reading about this Canadian guy who apparently is like the biggest thing in China.
Yeah.
I think his name is Dashan.
Yeah.
And he's only been there for like 10 years. And yeah. he owns Chinese TV. Like, yeah. You want a white guy in China on TV?
Yeah.
He's your guy.
Awesome. Yeah. But we're all the time, we're sending our college level kids overseas to learn a language. And they're coming back having taken college classes immersed in that target language. They're at a college level ability. Mm-hmm. It took them 2 years, 3 years, 4 years to get where it took that baby 20 years, right? So the reason is... the reason why kids inevitably learn, but adults are amazing at learning, is kids have a capacity for play. And play is a killer language or a killer learning accelerator, right? You really can't beat it. So a successful adult, who decides that they picked out their target language and goes for it is going to wire play somehow into that and build on that. And the more they build on the other things children do, and keep that ability honed, like children have a willingness to say it incorrectly. Mm-hmm. Children have a willingness to try out a statement that they know in a whole bunch of different contexts. My daughter is doing this. She's 2.5. And she's like, is this mine? Huh? Yes. Is it yours? No. Is it mom's? No. Is it my brother's? No. Is it mine? Yes. Right. Mm-hmm. And that's, scientists who study learning have words for that. And it's called variety and interleaving, where we're all constantly interweaving and wiring together different experiences and different colors of the same knowledge, right? And it makes for stronger capacity in the brain to express that ability and knowledge. So you take that, you turn it into a set of rules, right? And you game the rules, you find shortcuts and cheats. This is something children can't necessarily do. They don't develop their meta mind, thinking about thinking, learning about learning, you know, until like, I don't know, 10, 11, 12. When a college age learner, an adult, wow, there's some powerful ability to still be that sort of crazy echoes from childhood in their teen years are full of play and energy are still there. Mm-hmm. But the adult meta mind is strongly built and you get some of your strongest language learning and strongest memories from those college years, which are super impactful years for learning because of that play and a meta mind are at their peak. You know, it's like a Venn diagram. Mm-hmm. I'm 39 and I'm still fairly proud of my ability to learn languages. And it's because I have cultivated that sense of play, willingness to make mistakes, and I game it. I learn about learning. I make rules about how I learn and swap them with other language hunters, which is where the most exciting language learning happens. When you are learning Andabeli from a fellow language hunter, I mean, geez, what could have taken weeks takes hours, you know, I mean, your hair's flying. Mm. But even then, even with, language hunting was designed for an elder speaker who may be hard of hearing, maybe bitter about their language. Maybe they were beaten for speaking it when they were young, put in a residential school. Language hunting was designed for that most challenging of contexts. How can I create the most ease and safety and comfort and play in that situation? And like I say, because of that, because of the intensity of that challenge, it's almost like rocket engines on a stock car for, you know, like a language where, hey, we're good friends. Let's just learn some, you know, Ethiopian.
This is cool. This makes me feel like I'm going to be able to, like, literally, I feel like I'm going to be able to go and re-energize my relationship with my mother-in-law who lives with us.
Yes. Yeah.
Who may not feel that there's value in what she knows.
Yeah.
But then from the point of view of me as the language hunter, she is just walking, talking, valuable.
Right.
She's the living language.
Absolutely.
And she's in my house every day.
That's exactly how I see elder speakers all the time. I mean, it's funny. I meet someone who speaks a fascinating small language. And I mean, I like an Estonian speaker at this conference. And mm-hmm. I realize he's in Portland, which, I mean, this never happens. I go to conferences around the world and I'm like, oh, well, that's great. You speak Latvian. That's wonderful. I'm never going to see you again. So we'll do a tiny hunt and goodbye, you know? But, and I get so excited because it's an opportunity to develop that relationship and they mm-hmm. are this treasure house and every language gives you another way of experiencing the world, which more and more research is coming out showing how, the more languages you know, the more flexible and healthy your brain, and the more tools you have in your toolbox for troubleshooting your world.
Mm-hmm. And empathy for other cultures.
Oh, empathy and yes, all the good stuff.
Well, that's fantastic. So people can learn about this at languagehunters.org.
Languagehunters.org. We have a Google group. There's a blog, .languagehunters.org. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, and we invite you to participate in the community. Help us improve the ever-growing system of rules. Ask your questions. You know, it really is. It's a Creative Commons kind of system. Mm-hmm. Players from around the world are retooling the rules for their own context, for their own languages. Every language has its own set of challenges that you have to point these rules at to iterate on and to improve on.
And this also sounds like a fun activity for schools.
Yeah, absolutely. We're locally here in Portland, we're teaching Every week we do Irish, Russian, and Spanish in local schools. And it's really hilarious, actually. We did 3 months of Russian, and then I had my Russian instructor, and I decided, oh, now we'll teach them to write in Russian, right? Mm-hmm. And so there was no Russian writing at all for 3 months. It was all just conversation and mm-hmm. those hunts, right? And then we got to the writing, and it was like this alphabet that's supposed to be difficult, the Cyrillic alphabet with backwards R's and Greek letters, and yeah. it just flew off the page. And the first half hour, the kids were writing fluent, perfect sentences without a single error. I mean, like 99 out of 100 sentences were written without a single error. And I mean, that's the kind of thing that could happen because they already knew it. They already knew how to write English. So they knew how alphabets work.
So this is 3 months, 1 day a week they were learning this?
2 hours a week.
2 hours a week. Mm-hmm. Was it 2 one-hour sessions? I'm curious.
I had two one-hour sessions.
And after 3 months, kind of to conclude here, you've got a teenager mm-hmm. who's got some Russian now. Mm-hmm.
And they're actually younger kids. So it's
really?
So remember what I said about the meta minds?
Right.
It was difficult. It's ironically, it's more challenging with them. Mm. Ideally, we'd have an immersion environment, multi-age scenario, but this was, 9 to 11-year-olds. So mm-hmm. you're kind of straddling that. The meta minds are just starting to develop. Mm-hmm. But even in spite of that, yeah, I mean, we had what we call, we'd asked and answered all those journalism questions. Mm-hmm. We'd gotten to the point where we could take field trips to buy bus tickets, max tickets, right?
Really?
Yep.
That's what I want to understand. How far could they go? You could mm-hmm. take an 11-year-old and they could do what with it? Mm-hmm. Get on the bus, order mm-hmm. food?
Those would all be new hunts, keep in mind.
Okay.
But yes, they could get on the bus. They could, they can count. They can ask how you're doing. They can find things. They can ask, why do you want this? Why do you have that?
Wow.
They can trade objects. They can get their needs met, as we say, well, right? So without struggle, they can get their survival needs met. And if they ever don't have a word, nouns are cheap. All you have to say is, what is that? Что это? Right? In Russian, you know, what is that? That easy. Well, yeah. That's what it is. So, and then they've got the noun, and then they slip it into a sentence they're already fluent in. And so this is one of our tricks, our cheats that little kids don't necessarily know. Mm-hmm. Little kids want to ask, what is everything? We know that in the beginning, you want to start with a couple of cups. So in that hunt, how many nouns was in that hunt I gave you with the full cup, empty cup?
Two.
Yeah, one, really.
Well, cup and tea, maybe, I guess. It depends on
whether the speaker brings it up.
That's a good point.
So half the time it ends up being an empty cup and a cup of tea. Mm-hmm. But the other half of the time, it's just two cups. One is empty, one is full. And so you can whittle it down to even just one noun and two adjectives and then get a conversation going. And, you know, you grow from there, sure. But that's one of our cheats. We call it's vertical slicing. It's the exact same thing as vertical slicing. Children horizontally slice. So they go for a sea of language where we go for one fluent ability at a time.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is very, very cool. Thank you so much for chatting with me.
Yeah, thanks, Scott.
All right. Well, you can get all those links on the show notes and check out languagehunters.org. And of course, go Googling for Language Hunters and you'll find videos and resources and join the Google groups. This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.